You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, November 28th. Monday of the first week of Advent, also the feast day of St. Catherine Laboureille, who gave us the miraculous medal, or was a conduit by which our Lord gave us the miraculous medal. Anyway, my pleasure to have you here. Enjoy that conversation. If you missed it during the first hour, you want to check out the podcast for sure through Podbean or Google Play or iTunes. My conversation with Austin Ivory. You have the perfect storm with Austin Ivory, someone who, because of his British accent, sounds smarter and someone who actually is smarter. And I've kind of, one of the keys, I think, to learning is talk to people who are smarter than you. And Austin Ivory, my goodness, guy has got it on the ball and some really good insights into Fidel Castro, a much more complex figure, I think, than he's oftentimes understood to be. And part of the problem is, as he says, Ivory says, is, you know, we kind of look at this entirely from the American perspective. Fidel Castro, a ruthless dictator. But more of a complex thinker than you realize, and certainly the whole situation in Cuba, the depth of the faith of Catholics on the island there, the situation that the Cuban Revolution, the circumstances under which it began, some of the shifts that took place in terms of its attitude toward the church, both initially. Moving into the negative view toward the church, but then opening itself up more beginning in the 1990s to where it was no longer viewed as an atheist state, but as a secular state. And then just some of the information about the forming of Fidel Castro as a young student in Jesuit schools and so forth. It's a fascinating read, this Crux piece. There's a link to it on the show's website, the show's blog page, mikeallenshow.blogspot.com. You can check it out for sure. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you've got a comment or a question. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Austin Ivory's outstanding piece and retrospective on that, so definitely check it out. My question of the day here on this November 28th. It is Ed Harris's 66th birthday today. And I'm asking you to tell me what's your favorite Ed Harris film. 573-4-BREAD-4. Ed Harris may be one of those persons you know his face more than you know his name, but he's been in a lot of huge movies, significant films over the years. Rotten Tomatoes ranked out his 10 best movies this way. They said number 10, The Abyss. Number 9, Swing Shift. I have not seen that one. That one also with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. Number 8, Sweet Dreams, where he plays Patsy Cline's husband to Jessica Lange's Patsy Cline. Number 7, Glengarry Glen Ross. As I said, I saw that over the holiday weekend. First time I'd ever seen that film. The profanity will peel the paint, but it is quite an acting ensemble. And wow. You talk about the shadow side of capitalism. Watch Glengarry Glen Ross always be closing, as Alec Baldwin's character says. Number 6, The Truman Show. Yes, I agree, though I might move that up even higher. Number 5, Gone Baby Gone. I haven't seen that. Number 4, Apollo 13. Yeah, he was outstanding in that. Number 3, Snowpiercer. I have not seen. Number 2, Places in the Heart. And that's the film that Sally Field won Best Actress Oscar for back in 1984. And then The Right Stuff, 1983 film, playing the original Apollo astronauts. Or I'm sorry, the Mercury astronauts, the Mercury 7. So I can't believe, I think he got an Academy Award for Pollock, which, so that doesn't make his top 10, interestingly enough. So if you've got a thought on that, 573-4BREAD-4, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. As I said, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I got to enjoy time with family. My son was in for a visit. We had everybody together except my oldest daughter. And hopefully sometime after Christmas, we can all be together. But ate way too much. See, my problem is I start carving up the turkey. And believe me, I'm no expert at turkey carving. My turkey, but the way I look at it is the turkey tastes the same no matter what the slices look like. But my problem is I munch on the turkey while I slice it. So when it's time to actually sit down to eat, I've already filled half my stomach. So usually I'm only good for about one plate. Man, I can't eat like I did back in the day where I could eat two or three groaning platefuls and just be getting started. Not the same. I can't eat like I once did. But to my mother-in-law had her seriously good giblet gravy, which makes everything better for sure. So anyway, I'd love to hear from you if you want to chime again. And again, speaking of movies, I after seeing Glengarry Glen Ross, which to me paints the absolute shadow side of human human greed, backstabbing, backbiting, all the rest. Flipped around right after that and watched, again, we had a free movie channel preview this weekend, so a lot of movies on. I got to see the film St. Vincent. I don't know if you've seen this movie. Bill Murray, 2014 film. The film stars Bill Murray as the title character. Basically about a man who is this sort of, you know, curmudgeon-y, grumpy, alcoholic Vietnam War veteran living in Sheepshead Bay in New York. He smokes and gambles. And he has a neighbor move in, a single mother, and her son. And, he, you know, it's I guess you could say in some ways it's a fairly predictable plot in that over time, of course, it's sort of like the As Good As It Gets narrative. If you saw the Jack Nicholson film where the crusty, grumpy, eccentric person becomes more endearing as time goes by. And you kind of see that happen over the course of the film. But, you know, it really is when you get to the end of the movie, despite its, you know, it's not a perfect film by any means. But when you get to the end of the film and you see that the little boy who is supposed to at his local Catholic school report on saints among us, he declares Vincent his saint, and he kind of walks through his whole life story, and I'm man enough to admit I was a blubbering mess, because those, as I've told you before, you know, the movies that make me get emotional are not movies about, like, for example, if you remember the movie Back from the Day and the Terms of Endearment with Deborah Winger and Jeff Daniels, and, you know, the whole she's saying goodbye to her children on her deathbed sort of thing, which people just boohooed about. For some reason, that movie, that kind of thing has never gotten me that much in movies. I weep more for the tender exploration, I guess you could say, of virtue. When I see virtue, particularly when maybe you see virtue in an unexpected place, or virtue just shining forth as goodness in the human soul and in the human person, even despite all kind of flaws and sins and brokenness and all the rest, when you see that shining through, the healing power of virtue in particular, that's what gets me. And I guess I'm becoming one of these old men who cries at everything. But when I see virtue like that as portrayed in that film, virtue in an unexpected place, I get emotional. Speaking of virtue in unexpected places, the gospel reading for today. Jesus enters Capernaum, and a centurion, Roman centurion, approached him and appealed to him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, suffering dreadfully. Jesus said, I will come and cure him. The centurion said in reply, Lord, here's the great line we use in the Mass. Coming from a Roman, a Gentile, the centurion said in reply, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you enter under my roof. Only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man subject to authority, with soldiers subject to me. I say to one, go, and he goes, and another, come here, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those who followed him, to those following him. You know what's significant when Jesus is amazed? Most of the time in the Gospels you read, it's Jesus doing things that cause others to be amazed. But when he discovers the faith of the centurion, and it's usually faith, by the way, that amazes our Lord when you see those rare moments in the Gospels. Here, from a Roman centurion, not from a Jew. As I said, this is the line we say in the Mass. I know there were some complaints when we brought the new translation of the liturgy in, where it used to say, Lord, I'm not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and I will be healed. We went more explicitly biblical. Lord, I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed. I like the change because I think it makes more explicit the connection to the surprising faith of a Roman centurion. We'll talk a little bit more about this when we come back from the break. Virtue in unexpected places. Something to look for during this Advent season. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this November 28th, this Monday, the feast day of St. Catherine Laboureille, who received a vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary and the vision of the Miraculous Medal. Hopefully that you have one blessed. It's a beautiful sacramental, one of the more beautiful ones of our faith, I believe. My question of the day, Ed Harris, 66 years old today, what is your favorite Ed Harris movie? You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can call me or text me at 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter. Some folks have done exactly that. Let me see some of the other comments. Tom says, Under Fire. I don't think I've seen that one from Ed Harris. Dave says, Appaloosa. Andy says, The Rock. Adia says Apollo 13. David, The Right Stuff. Les says, ooh, who is Ed Harris? To which I responded with a photo of Harris on my Facebook page. He's got, one of those very familiar faces. Maybe you don't know who he is. Edwin says The Truman Show. Yeah, I love The Truman Show. That I'm still trying to figure out whether that movie is pro-religion or anti-religion. I can't really figure it out because you think on the one hand, it seems to be some sort of a direct attack at faith in God as some sort of mind-controlling, world-controlling, vision-limiting, oppressive reality. Then on the other hand, there are parts of the movie that make you think it's faith that opens Truman up to a world beyond himself. So if you've got that figured out, I would love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You could email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We were talking last segment about virtue in unexpected places. As I said, I saw the film St. Vincent. Of course, it's got Bill Murray, and I love Bill Murray. But Bill Murray, very underrated in terms of his acting ability. Not just funny. I mean, he is definitely funny, and he has a certain niche typically as an actor. But that movie, very, very well done and very touching. As I said, the gospel reading very much related to this idea of virtue in unexpected places. This centurion who amazes Jesus with his faith, his statement, in fact, has woven its way into our liturgy. Lord, I'm not worthy to have you enter under my roof. Only say the word and my servant will be healed. This is from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8. Of course, Matthew's Gospel also contains at the very beginning its genealogy of Jesus, which includes people like Ruth, for example, or Rahab, the prostitute in Jericho who hid the Hebrew spies, also a Gentile. I've been talking to my class, my Old Testament class, a little bit in terms of, you know, you have those three books right in a row after the Pentateuch. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Lyle Lovett had an album of that title a number of years ago, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. But one of the things I talked about with my class is, you know, the whole story of Joshua and Judges and Ruth are all set during the period sometimes known as the conquest. After the wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, after the Israelites come into Canaan, which was already occupied, by the way, by the Canaanites, and begins the process of making it their own. Joshua and Judges, different in the sense that in Joshua, the graph of the conquest is more a straight line sloping upward of victory, though there are a couple of setbacks, and the enemy is destroyed. In Judges, they're sort of living among the Canaanites, and when they're at their best, they're rejecting the idolatry of the Canaanites and winning victories. When they're at their worst, they are being disobedient and falling prey to idolatry and also being defeated by their enemies. But the common ground between Joshua and Judges is that the enemy nations, the enemy peoples, the occupiers of the promised land, are seen as enemies to be eliminated, wiped out. This is where you see the Old Testament idea of the ban, which an entire city, people group, were to be eliminated without exception. A man, woman, child, and so forth, even all the animals, wiped out because of the danger of the intermingling and the influence of compromise that would come with the pagan peoples. The book of Ruth, a notable exception. In the book of Ruth, Ruth, the daughter of Naomi, who shows her remarkable fidelity. You know, Naomi is a Jewish woman who has left her native Bethlehem to move to Moab with her husband because of a famine. While she's there, her husband, Elimelech, dies, as well as her two sons who have married Moabite women, non-Jews. They both die. And Naomi finds herself in desperate straits, hears that the famine has lifted in her native Bethlehem and decides to return home. Her daughters-in-law, the widowed wives of her sons, follow along, but Naomi turns back and says to both of them, both Ruth and Orpah, believe it or not, that's actually the name that is on Oprah Winfrey's birth certificate. She was actually named Orpah, but it was mispronounced Oprah so many times she just went with it. But I digress. Naomi tells them to go back to their own native lands and to their own peoples, which Orpah agrees, but Ruth clings to Naomi. In fact, there's this beautiful vow that she makes. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you die, there I will die and be buried, and your God will be my God, and so forth. It's a beautiful vow. I stole this idea from my sister, by the way, but actually have that reference from the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, inscribed on the inside of my wedding ring. Beautiful vow of fidelity. But Ruth, the Moabite, showing a virtue that not only leads to the redemption of Naomi's family line through Ruth's own marriage to Boaz. But as I said, you see Ruth, again, the non-Jew, as a vital part of salvation history through her own virtue, virtue in unexpected places. It's her name that gets listed in Jesus' genealogy, one of only four women listed in Jesus' genealogy. And so much like the centurion in today's gospel reading, unexpected virtue. And so what I was saying is, you know, Advent is a good time perhaps to be reflecting upon where can we find virtue unexpectedly, maybe even in our own lives, maybe in people around us that we would be too quick to write off as being problematic or simply difficult. Perhaps there's virtue there to be seen, and Advent is an opportunity for a greater level of attentiveness to where we can see that virtue at work. And you know, we see in that, of course, with Ruth and also with the Roman centurion, foreshadowings of a sort of the universal mission of the church. Founded originally in Judaism, but therefore the blessing of all the nations of the world. So anyway, pretty cool. If you've got a response or a thought on any of that, 573-4BREAD-4. Love to hear from you, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We were talking last hour about the death of Fidel Castro and all the various responses from around the world. It is quite interesting, you know, to see the polarity of reactions. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, sent this telegram to Raul Castro, the brother of the late Fidel. He hailed Castro as, quote, a symbol of a whole era of modern world history, saying he was a wise and strong person and an inspiring example for all countries and peoples and a sincere and reliable friend of Russia. Pope Francis sent a telegram to Raul Castro as well, writing, upon receiving the sad news of the passing of your beloved brother, the Honorable Fidel Castro Ruz, former president of the State Council and government of the Republic of Cuba, I express my sadness to Your Excellency and all family members of the deceased dignitary, as well as the government and the people in that beloved nation. At the same time, I offer my prayers for his eternal rest, and I entrust the Cuban people to the maternal intercession of Our Lady of La Caridad del Cobre, patroness of that country. Now, people oftentimes forget what a deep Catholic piety there is in Cuba, particularly Marian devotion. I remember reading a number of years ago, Seven Story Mountain, Thomas Merton's autobiography, and before going into the Trappist monastery there near Bardstown, Kentucky, back in the 1930s, he went and spent some time there in Cuba and went to the shrine there at Our Lady of Charity, Our Lady of Cobre, patroness of Cuba. Let's see, Rafael Correa, president of Ecuador, tweeted, he was a big one, Fidel dead, long live Cuba, long live Latin America. There was a certain sense in which Castro was a symbol of self-assertion in Latin America in many ways. Let's see what some of the negative. Boris Johnson, the British foreign minister, tweeted, Fidel Castro's death marks the end of an era for Cuba and a start of a new one for Cuba's people. Let's see. We'll get into a few other, well, we're out of time. We'll get back to this on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Well,
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Monday, the 28th of November, feast day of St. Catherine Labouret, as well as Monday of the first week of Advent. We're coming to you live from Breadbox Media. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, just go to breadboxmedia.com. Download the app onto your digital device if you have one. You can always have Breadbox Media with you in your pocket. You can always also stream live via the internet through a laptop or another digital device. And you can also discover some of the other programming on the station by listening to podcasts if you don't catch them live. Go to Podbean, iTunes, or Google Play and find out some of the different contributors we have in every corner of this country and across the heartland. You can also become a friend of your favorite show. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And through your monthly support, receive not only the pleasure of knowing you're supporting programming you believe in, but also exclusive access to online content. So check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Again, my question of the day on Ed Harris's 66th birthday, what is your favorite Ed Harris film? We didn't get a chance to do this in the last hour, but let's look back in history a little bit on some other things that have happened on this day throughout the ages. November 28th. 1520, Portuguese navigator Ferdinand Magellan reached the Pacific Ocean after passing through the South American Strait that now bears his name. 1820, the birthday of Friedrich Engels. We're talking about Marxism a little bit with Austin Ivory and particularly the death of Fidel Castro. Engels, of course. You wonder if Karl Marx without... That's sort of the irony, you know? Would Karl Marx have had the influence he had without Friedrich Engels' money, which presumably he earned through non-communist means? Just saying. 1895, the America's first auto race organized by the Chicago Times-Herald from Chicago to Evanston and back. Six cars traveling 55 miles. The winner averaged 7 miles an hour. Just for perspective, by the way, the Rascal Scooter can reach speeds of 10 miles an hour. So that was some kind of race, I guess. In 1925, the Grand Ole Opry made its debut, 91 years ago. In 1943, President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin all met in Tehran during World War II. Happy birthday to Randy Newman, vocalist, pianist, Short People, I Love L.A., and so forth. You got a friend in me, born in New Orleans. 67 years old today, Paul Schaefer. David Letterman band leader. Alexander Gudinov would be if he were still with us. Talented actor and ballet star. Let's see. 1978, Reds fire Sparky Anderson, manager after 9 years. Maybe the worst coaching decision in the history of management there. Let's see. In 1981, Bear Bryant won his 315th game to outdistance Alonzo Stagg and become college football's winningest coach. I think that title now held by Bobby Bowden, I believe. Let's see, 1986, Ahmad Rashad's marriage proposal accepted by Felicia Ayers Allen during halftime of the Detroit Lions-New York Jets football game. Unfortunately, I think their marriage ended in divorce, sadly enough. And President Bill Clinton on this day in 95 signed a bill that ended the federal 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. So anyway, that's some of the stuff down through the ages. Again, my question of the day, it's Ed Harris's 66th birthday. What is your favorite Ed Harris film? We were talking about reactions to the death of Fidel Castro. We were talking about the ones that were more positive in nature. Then you have this statement from Gloria Estefan, a very famous Cuban expat. There are many of them, of course, particularly in southeastern Florida. But she posted a photo of Cuban refugees on a raft and wrote on Instagram, "Although the death of a human being is rarely cause for celebration, it is the symbolic death of the destructive ideologies that Castro espoused that I believe is filling the Cuban exile community with a renewed hope and a relief that has been long in coming. She added, although the grip of Castro's regime will not loosen overnight, the demise of a leader that oversaw the annihilation of those with an opposing view, the indiscriminate jailing of innocents, the separation of families, the censure of his people's freedom to speak, state-sanctioned terrorism, and the economic destruction of a once thriving and successful country can only lead to positive change for the Cuban people and our world. And then President-elect Donald Trump with a statement. His first initial tweet was, Fidel Castro is dead! Exclamation point. And then he, followed that up a few hours later with a lengthier statement in which he called Castro a brutal dictator who oppressed his own people for nearly six decades, and said he hoped that Castro's death gave Cuban Americans the hope of one day soon seeing a free Cuba. Fidel Castro's legacy is one of firing squads, theft, unimaginable suffering, poverty, and the denial of fundamental human rights, the statement said. While Cuba remained a totalitarian island, it is my hope that today marks a move away from the horrors endured for too long and toward a future in which the wonderful Cuban people finally live in the freedom they so richly deserve. One of the things about that, too, is it's easy to forget that life before Castro and before the Castro regime was not exactly peaches and cream. I mean, the Batista dictatorship before the Cuban Revolution was also a human rights disaster. And I think it is important, and I think this is where Austin Ivory in the last hour helped us a little bit, to see that the seeds of the Cuban Revolution, the original seeds of the Cuban Revolution, were really rooted in, I think, sound principles of justice. And Latin America's autonomy and Latin American, a desire for a more just order, social order. It was when Marxism became involved, and as Austin Ivory suggests, it was, American reaction probably did not help. It gave the Castros a sense of identity as being anti-American and brought them, of course, into a closer partnership with Soviet communism and other regimes that placed the island at increasing odds. And it was the U.S. embargo, perhaps, that gave Castro even greater leverage with his own people. Who knows? But as it typically is the case, a much more complicated scenario than our quick categories, for sure. Interestingly enough, and I'd hoped to have Archbishop Thomas Winsky of the Archdiocese of Miami on the program today. Evidently, he has laryngitis and unable to be with us. But Archbishop Thomas Winsky of Miami, where, as I said, there's a huge expatriate Cuban community, those who fled Castro's Cuba and now live and still harbor, of course, great negativity toward the Castro regime and all that it is. Archbishop Thomas Winsky, with a difficult place to be in terms of making a statement on this, but here's his official statement. In the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, we read, both the just and the wicked God will judge, since a time is set for every affair and for every work. Fidel Castro has died. Now he awaits the judgment of God, who is merciful, but also just. His death provokes many emotions, both in and outside the island. Nevertheless, beyond all possible emotions, the passing of this figure should lead us to invoke the patroness of Cuba, the Virgin of Charity, asking for peace for Cuba and its people. He says, to Jesus, through Mary, charity unites us. May Holy Mary, Our Lady of Charity, hear her people's prayers and hasten for Cuba the hour of its reconciliation and truth, accompanied by freedom and justice. May, through the intercession of the Virgin Mambisa, the Cuban people know how to traverse that narrow road between fear, which gives in to evil and violence, which under the illusion of fighting evil only makes it worse. Our Lady of Charity, cover us with your mantle. As I said, that's a beautiful statement, I think, tapping into the deep Marian piety of the Catholic Church and the presence of the Catholic Church in Cuba, which, you know, even with the officially atheistic state for so long, which is now listed as just a secular state, the Church has managed to survive and continue to be a place of refuge there on the island. And certainly we pray that when finally Raul Castro also passes from this life, it will be an opportunity for a new springtime of freedom in Cuba, one that's deeply rooted in its faith. And that this is, you know, I think where they have an opportunity to experience something in Cuba that could be a model even for the rest of the Western world, one that doesn't see faith somehow as an enemy, but intrinsic to the building of a just social order. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
Advent is here. Be ready. Or as my friend likes to say, be alert. The world needs more alerts. You know, we talk particularly early in Advent. It's about preparing for the return of Christ at the end of human history. But when that is, we don't know, of course. Jesus said no one knows the day or the hour. People who have made a cottage industry of predicting the date over the decades, I don't know why it's so hard to learn. No man, that means you. Anyway, but the truth is, even though we don't know where Christ's return will become in human history, we will have our own coming of Jesus, our own come to Jesus at the end of our lives. And that is something that we do not know the date or hour of as well. It's come for Fidel Castro. It will come for us too. And we will stand before God and we will give account for our lives and we will throw ourselves upon the mercy of Jesus. But as is typically the case, we want justice for others. We want mercy for ourselves. And that's something to think about during this season of Advent. How prepared are we for the reality that our lives will come to an end and we will stand before our Lord face to face and we will give an accounting for our lives? It's one thing I would say. I saw a little bit of a snippet. I don't know how many years ago it was. Diane Sawyer doing an interview with Fidel Castro, and she asked him if he believed in heaven and hell. And of course he said he didn't at the time. Whether his mind changed as he faced his impending death, who knows? But it was another example to me of how ironic it is that we as Christian believers oftentimes get accused of conjuring belief as a sort of anesthetizing, you know, soothing idea, right? That we that our faith is wishful thinking to give us some comfort in life. But couldn't it also be argued that for a guy like Fidel Castro, rejecting belief in God, rejecting in a final judgment or an idea of a final judgment, rejecting that he will one day be accountable for his actions, could that not also be seen as wishful thinking? For sure. Well, he knows for sure now, and we do. We entrust him to the perfect, just, and merciful
judge, as Archbishop Winsky said. An interesting piece I came across this weekend on this from CityLab, which is a great little website for, I guess you could say, true human ecology, as Pope Francis wrote about in Laudato Si. But this piece by David Dudley called The Devil's Hairdryer. Hell is other people. I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre who said that back in the day. But anyway, hell is other people with leaf blowers. Dudley says a bunch of neighbors were sitting around the other night talking yard work, and the conversation returned to a frequent target, a certain ex-neighbor, now long gone, who was unduly fond of his leaf blower. This is a familiar tale, how he tormented the block every autumn weekend, chasing leaves around his small yard with his shrieking machine, leaving behind the lingering stench of gasoline fumes and resentment. I never met this fellow. He moved out before I moved in, but his legacy is secure. He is the blank with a leaf blower. And since it is family-friendly radio, I will not reveal the blank. Dudley says, perhaps that's redundant. The tragedy of the leaf blower is that it makes blanks of us all, users and neighbors alike. The aggressively uncivil nature of these devices is the stuff of legend. And he goes on to bring up arguments that that Atlantic writer James Fallows has used in his epic campaign against leaf blowers. He says this was interesting information. Number one, he said, the crude little two-stroke engines used by most commercial backpack-style blowers are pollution bombs. Simplest benchmark, running a leaf blower for 30 minutes creates more emissions than driving an F-150 pickup truck 3,800 miles. About one-third of the gasoline that goes into this sort of engine is spewed out, unburned, in an aerosol mixed with oil in the exhaust. Wow! 30 minutes of the leaf blower creates more emissions than driving a pickup truck 3,800 miles. He goes on to say those emissions, plus all the other fine particulate stuff that the blowers kick up, constitute a public health hazard for anyone in the vicinity, but especially for the poor person running the thing. In most cities and suburbs, that's usually low-wage employees of landscaping companies. And then the third point he makes is the noise, make it stop. A gas blower at full cry can exceed 100 decibels for the operator. OSHA requires hearing protections at 85, by the way. And it carries for hundreds of feet in every direction, irritating all who dwell therein. See, this makes me feel a little bit better about not having a leaf blower myself. Believe me, I've got several huge trees in my yard and find myself with the unenviable task, as much as I can engage my children in helping, to raking these leaves every year. And there are times that I think to myself, man, it'd be nice to have a leaf blower. Reading this article now, I'm not so sure. I think I'm better off sticking with a rake, not only because of the impact that it can have on your neighbors, but also on the environment. My goodness, hadn't thought about that. So I'll post a link to that on the show's Facebook page. You can read about it. Hell is other people with leaf blowers. I saw a somewhat related piece from NPR a couple weeks ago about other noisy distractions, particularly from our coworkers. And that there's nothing more handicapping to our productivity on the job than the noises that we emit from ourselves around our coworkers, particularly those who have to listen to coworkers who sneeze and hack coughs throughout this cold and flu season. That was an interesting piece too. So I'll send that your way, especially in this cubicle world we live in. Nightmares of what are the worst noise-offending behaviors, like eating frozen carrots or hacking coughs of bronchitis. There are other noises, the piece says, that fall into that indelicate in-between territory, like flatulence. 4 years ago, the Social Security Administration reprimanded a worker for his excessive flatulence. After numerous complaints and warnings, the agency charged him with conduct unbecoming a federal employee. The employee claimed he had lactose intolerance, and after his union intervened, his reprimand was rescinded. Really, you're ripping them in your cubicle office space? Oh, my goodness. This is a pretty funny article as well. So keep the noise down. The overall message, I guess, of this segment. Anyway, let's go on to Dalek Catechism, and let's go to random.org, our random number generator. We'll spin up a number between 1 and 2865, total number of paragraphs in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. See what Providence has in store. Of course, we know truth is never random, always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 893 is the paragraph. Almost there. It's in the Profession of Faith section, the Creed. Here we go. The Sanctifying Office. This is under the section on the hierarchy of the church. The bishop is the steward of the grace of the supreme priesthood, especially in the Eucharist, which he offers personally, or whose offering he assures through his priests, his co-workers. The Eucharist is the center of the life of the particular church. The bishop and priests sanctify the church by their prayer and work, by their ministry of the word and of the sacraments. They sanctify her by their example, not as domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. Thus, together with the flock entrusted to them, they may attain to eternal life. There are a lot of references here to the document from the Second Vatican Council called Lumen Gentium. This is, you know, a reminder to me that every Mass within a diocese that is celebrated, the proper minister of that sacrament, of the Mass, is the bishop. The ministry of the priest exists because a bishop can't be everywhere. It's in the bishop that is the fullness of holy orders. The fullness of Christ's priesthood is given to the bishop, who is, of course, a successor to the apostles. As Jesus said, those who receive you receive me. Those who receive me receive the one who sent me. And so to share in a Eucharist is to share in union with the local ordinary, the local bishop, who is the chief shepherd for that region. So pray for your bishop today and give thanks for him as embodying the fullness of Christ's priesthood. We'll be back by God's grace tomorrow. Go watch an Ed Harris movie, celebrate his birthday. Let's get Advent started right. This is the Mike Allen Show. You've been listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.